Welcome to Get Over It, the Consciousness Transforming Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. Folks, we've got one of my favorite people back. We're going to be speaking with Danielle Dusky today, and we're going to be talking about her book, Seasons of Moon and Flame, The Wild Dreamer's Epic Journey of Becoming. Now, if you don't remember, Danielle's a practicing witch, and she's a good witch. So she's going to talk about her book that is giving us so much information. I mean, in the space of just over 300 pages, well, almost 400 pages, she packs an encyclopedia of information. So if you're interested in witchcraft at all and wanting to delve deeper, this book is definitely for you. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you shift your consciousness to break through blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you let go of the BS that's holding you back, but you guys always know, I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience supporting people to break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing cutting-edge information that enables you to prosper and thrive. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I'm the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I also author 2 books. I provide consultations and healings in all areas of life that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your very best life. My clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence, but they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist, so whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. My guest today, Danielle Dusky, is a heathen visionary, pagan poet, and word witch. The author of Seasons of the Moon and Flame, The Holy Wild, Woman Most Wild. She teaches internationally and has facilitated circles, communal spell work, and seasonal rituals since 2007. She is the founder of the Hag School and believes in the emerging power of wild collectives, cunning witches, and rebellious artists in healing our ailing world. You can check her out online at her website, and that's DanielleDusky.com, and that's DanielleDusky.com. And today we're going to be focusing on her new book, Seasons of Moon and Flame, The Wild Dreamer's Epic Journey of Becoming. Welcome back, Danielle.
Thank you so much, Monique. Very happy to be here.
I am so glad to have you back. And folks, her other books that we have interviewed her on are on this website, this podcast site. So do check it out so that you can build your information around what Danielle is sharing. Now, Danielle, let's go back to a couple of basics for folks who haven't heard the other podcast. You are call yourself a witch. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why is it important? Well, first of all, explain what you describe a witch to be.
Yeah. So first, I usually like to answer that question by saying that any witch will give you a different answer. My answer is that a witch is anyone who meets both of 2 conditions. And the first one is that they call themselves a witch. So they've claimed the name witch for themselves instead of, you know, having it kind of given to them by an external authority. So they've claimed the name witch for themselves. And then the second condition is that they practice witchcraft. So there's a lot of people that practice witchcraft that don't call themselves witches. And then there are a lot of people that might call themselves witches that they don't actually practice witchcraft. So my definition is that you really need to do both. And witchcraft, though, can take any number of forms. So in my work, what I'm usually doing is trying to help people figure out what their unique witchcraft is as an art and a practice instead of a religion.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit more about witchcraft, because, you might be in the kitchen creating something. Is that a form of witchcraft?
It is, given the right intention, sure. The witches that we might call our foremothers, they didn't have the metaphysical stores that they could go and spend $100 on the right broom or the right wand. So, you know, a wand was a stick, and the broom was a broom, and the cauldron was what they cooked in. So, anything can be witchcraft given the right intention, almost anything. Ooh.
Okay, now, you also utilize the word hag, and hag
Thank
has
you.
So many, when you, yeah, I'm right there with you, but a lot of people feel that hag has such negative connotations with it.
Yeah.
But you talk about hag in the, I don't know, essence of truth. So tell us, explain to us what you envision a hag to be and why the hag is so important, especially in today's world?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the word hag, much like crone and also witch, it's in the process of being reclaimed. And it's probably, out of those three, it's probably the least palatable. People have kind of befriended witch and crone, but hag is still a little bit, they're not quite there yet. So hag is one of those terms that exists on the fringes of what is palatable and acceptable, which to me as a writer are always the most interesting words. So for me, a hag is the archetype that embodies the magic of, like, the woman who lives in the woods, who kind of holds all of this wisdom and does exist on the fringes, just like the word does. So she's not totally isolated from the community, but she's not totally in the center of it either. In that way, her medicine is a lot stronger. So for me, the hag is the wise elder archetype.
Okay. So is there a series of progression, like there's maiden, mother, crone, and you think of the maiden as a young lady, the mother is someone within the age of being able to foster children, and then the crone being an older lady like me. So is there progression in your lineage that leads up to hag, or is everyone a hag from the beginning?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that, to a certain extent, we embody all of those archetypes all the time. And I've certainly been, in my younger years, I was part of traditions where it did have that very linear progression. I went to a pagan festival when I was 25 years old, and I had my first son, and I wasn't allowed to wrap the maypole on Beltane on May Day because I had a kid. So I was no longer a maiden. I was mother. And it was such a bummer because, I was 25 years old.
You wanted to do that,
And I wanted to do that. So I've been part of traditions where there is this linear perspective of maiden, mother, crone, but witches, one of the key parts of magic is that you're defying linear time. You're kind of looking at the visions that you're trying to manifest as already happening somewhere on some plane. So if we're trying to break with linear time, then we really do need to be a little bit more flexible with this idea of progressive feminine archetypes. And also, I had this realization a few weeks ago when I was reading folk tales and fairy tales, like I do often, where I was thinking, like, this hag in the woods, like, people didn't live that long back then. I'm 40 years old, and that hag is probably like me.
If
the folk tales from, the 14 or 1500s, how old was the hag?
Yeah, she wasn't that old. she just wasn't that old. Now, in your book, Seasons of Moon and Flame, it has four parts, and the four parts represent the four houses of the seasons, because we celebrate four seasons here. So talk to us a little bit about the House of Garden Hag, which is spring.
Yeah, the house of the garden hag. So that corresponds to the solar season of spring, and then the three moons of spring. spring. So I'm looking in the book at the lunar seasons also, as kind of contained within the four big solar seasons. So the house of the garden hag is a very lusty grandmother, which are two terms that we don't usually put together, but she's the lusty grandmother, and she's a storyteller, and she approaches life with curiosity and humor, and she doesn't take herself too seriously. Yeah, so, you know, she welcomes you into her house, and she tells you certain stories, like the story of Body Betty, which is sort of one of the funnier stories in the book. And and then all of the spells that are in the book and the rituals and the writing, they're all built off of the stories that the hag shares.
Okay, and now talk to us about the Desert Hag, which is the summer portal.
Yeah, the Desert Hag is a little bit more serious than the Garden Hag. So the Desert Hag, also a storyteller. She speaks a lot about gratitude. So around summer solstice, our magic is a little bit more accessible in terms of the embodied feeling that you're trying to harness, because in summer, that feeling is gratitude. So most people know what gratitude feels like. So when newer witches are coming to witchcraft and they're asking where to start, I usually recommend that they start with gratitude magic, because it's more accessible than other types of magic and embodied feeling. So the Desert Hag speaks to us about gratitude and the grateful heart. And toward the end of summer, the way our gratitude sort of turns into grief. So we only grieve for things that we were grateful for. So that's one of the lessons of the Desert Hag.
Okay, and then the Sea Hag, which was Autumn Portal. And I'm thinking Sea Autumn. But explain that to us.
I know. So in the Celtic tradition, the west, the direction of west, is the element of water, and then the season of autumn. So the sea hag is sort of the most bizarre hag in the book, because she's kind of spectral and sort of disembodied and not seen readily. So her stories are more ghost stories, and her magic is a little bit not darker, but a little bit more intense. And she speaks about, you know, the importance of the paradox and holding the tension of opposites in magic. So it gets a little bit more complicated when you visit the sea hag. Yeah.
Okay, and then the mountain hag, because she's all about winter.
Yes, the mountain hag in winter. So that's the hag that is the most like my own grandmother. So at the beginning of the book, I talk about how, you know, the book is sort of structured according to the rhythm of visits to my grandmother's house in my early 20s, where she would sort of welcome me in and feed me something, and then she would give me the what I called the bite, which was like, you know, some sort of challenging question that felt kind of sharp and not usually comfortable. And like, what do you think you're doing with your life anyway?
Yeah, she's helping you expand your knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that would be the integration. So the mountain hag is sort of like most like my grandmother, in that she's a little bit bitter. She's not particularly warm like the summer hag is, but she does have this deep, very potent medicine. So, you know, it's in her language, she seems not very nurturing and maternal, but in her wisdom she is.
Okay. As you were describing each of the hags, I thought about different people in my life and how they exemplify that particular hag. I don't know if they would be open to hearing about it, but it definitely exemplify those traits. Folks, we're speaking with Danielle Dulski. We're talking about her latest book, and that's Seasons of Moon and Flame. And you can check her out at her website, and that's DanielleDulski.com. And Dan, it's spelled DanielleDulski.com. Danielle, in your book, you share a lot of elder stories, and it seems very important for you to get this information out about the elders. Why do elders play such a big role in your life and in your book? And second to that, why is it, or why do you think it is, here in the United States, we tend to want to discard our elders?
I know. And that's never been more apparent, right?
Yeah, than right now with the virus.
Than
yes.
right now, yes. So the first question, I believe that elderhood is everything. Elderhood as a practice, elderhood in spiritual traditions. You know, elders are the ones that historically have kind of been the ones to rein you in, and so uh-huh. like to gift you with the wisdom, yes, but then also, you know, walk with you on your path so that you don't go down the rabbit hole of, you know, whatever spiritual tradition you're going down the rabbit hole of. Uh-huh. The elders were the ones that would make sure that you were, you know, that you were staying true and not, you know, leaking your power and giving up too much of your energy. So, you know, the fact that we don't have them a lot anymore in our lives is really unfortunate. And the teachers of mine that have been true elders, they, like Dr. Estes, I studied with her this past summer. So Dr. Estes, uh-huh. who wrote Women Who Run with the Wolves, and, you know, she does have this, the true elders to me, they have this spirit where they have somehow been able to maintain this innocence and kind of childlike perspective. Uh-huh. And then at the same time, they have this, like, fierce, you know, like direction, and they sort of hold that tension and dance between those two apparent polarities beautifully in a way that seems really organic. And I know that it has been hard won, but it's also, you know, something that I feel like eludes people that haven't achieved the experience of elderhood, including myself. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's why elderhood is so important. And as far as why we don't value it, I could give all sorts of reasons for why we don't value it in the West. I think it all comes down to, you know, capitalism and colonialism, which are the two uh-huh. big ills, and how, you know, elders are kind of looked at as not being particularly productive, and so they're not good for the capitalist machine, and so probably it started there. Uh-huh. But, yeah, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah, well, it seems so sad that we throw away so much wisdom, or we refuse to pay attention to so much wisdom. Because frankly, if somebody's managed to live 60, 70, 80, 90 years, they've got some wisdom. Mm-hmm. They didn't get to be there by being idiots, you know?
Right.
and I don't understand, you know, because there's other nations in the world that, you know, the elders revered. And we start out with, you know, okay, I am on my own now. I am leaving home, which is good. But then mm-hmm. when, you know, grandma is of a certain age and she needs more help, we're putting her away, or we're putting grandpa away. We don't want to engage with them anymore. It's like they're yeah. dirty and nasty and stinky, and we don't want to have anything to do with them. And it just boggles my mind as to why we won't, like, bring them in the home and nurture them and love them.
Yeah, right. I don't know, other than, you know, anything can become a pattern if you see other people doing it enough.
So it
has become normalized.
Yeah. And the nursing home industry, you know, did a great job with, you know, no, place them here. We'll take really good care of them, which was a lie, but I yeah. digress. We won't go down that
yeah.
rabbit hole. why is storytelling such an important spiritual practice to you?
Storytelling is important because of not the words that the storyteller speaks, and not so much what the listener might hear, but that space in between those two places. So, like, the place where the story gets met, so the place where the story gets changed because of whatever particular, unique, and unprecedented constellation of listeners are there listening to that story will be different because of who is there and who hears it, and what time of day it is, and season, and all of that. So a story is very much co-created by all of these different forces that exist beyond the words that might be spoken. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a story has the power to do any number of things. A story can be a spell in itself. A myth, which not mm-hmm. all stories are myths, but a myth has a power to shape an entire culture. right? Uh-huh. So stories are important on an individual level because they let you make sense of your own lived experience if you shape your whole, the epic novel of your life into a story. It's such a powerful experience, even if you kind of do it spontaneously, just talking through it, not necessarily writing it down. It has a way of making you hero or heroine and looking at different elements in your life as potentially magical and not quite as mundane as you thought they were. So yeah, storytelling, very important in my practice and my work.
Okay. There's also another word that you use often in your book, and that is grandmother. What is the difference between the hag and the grandmother, or is there?
Yeah, there is a difference. I'm using the word grandmother because, to a certain extent, all of the hags, though I said the mountain hag is much more akin to her pet personality, but all of the hags to a certain extent are born from my own paternal grandmother who pretty much raised me half of the time. I was with her more than half the time when I was younger. So, you know, grandmother just evokes this sense in people that I don't know that I was really thinking about it while I was writing the book, but having, you know, heard from people that are reading it, like, grandmother really evokes this sense of, like, grief, but not, you know, like, good grief, not necessarily because they're thinking of their own grandmothers that they've lost, but there's this sense of, like, you know, having lost that part of the village. We've lost the village entirely, but especially lost that wise elder in the village. So there is a kind of mournful quality to it, but there's also kind of like a magnetism, like we do know that that is something that needs to be reclaimed, and there's sort of just a wondering how to do it. What's the right way to do it?
Okay, so we're in this time of the coronavirus, and, you know, a lot of people are, well, if they're still here with us, because so many people have made their transition, a lot of people are trying to figure out, you know, why this came, why this pandemic at this time, and why so many lives. From your perspective of being a practicing witch, how do you address that, or do you?
Yeah, I have not been so bold as to say why it happened, at least not publicly.
Okay.
I've made some assumptions on my own. But I think that, like, in my work, so I had a lot of things planned, not just for the book promotion, but I also had like some retreats and immersions that were planned that kind of got moved onto the online environment. And so I've had a lot of opportunity to connect with a large number of people and kind of sitting with what I call the unanswerable questions, like, why is this happening? And like talking about the grief over the meetings that aren't happening, but then also how there's this strange, not joy necessarily, but there's this strange sense of like comfort, even among the people that, you know, they don't know where their next paycheck's coming from. You know, so even among the people where the story is not good because of the virus, there's still this weird sense of like how their life previously was sort of unsustainable. And I know that I feel that in myself too, like going back and looking at my calendar for what I was meant to be doing during the past 2 months was sort of like, what was I thinking? And like, I know that I would have done it. But there's this sense of like, what was I thinking trying to move so quickly? And, you know, that would have been exhausting and all of that. So I do think that there's something to the virus exposing how fragile a lot of our systems are and how unsustainable huge parts of our lives were. So I don't know if that's the reason, but that's what I'm feeling as a, you know, something that's kind of arising within me, trying to make sense of it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like coming back to balance, you know, coming back to basics. And I think Mother Earth is like tired of the BS, and that's bullshit that we put her through, and she's like reclaiming, you know, her sovereign territory, if you will. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Now, these days, there are so many people claiming to be a witch, you know, witchy is on trend now. Why? And it's not always, why?
Why is witch trendy? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there is a, on the positive end of why, you know, the being a witch is sort of becoming trendy. There is, something to needing to heal the earth, or at least if we're not going to revere the earth as a collective, like we still need to wake up and pay attention. So a witch works with the elements and nature. I mean, most fundamentally, regardless of tradition, regardless of ancestry, whether you're a hereditary witch or you're just sort of like, you know, watching Sabrina and you decide that it's something that you want to try, you know, regardless of the form that the witchcraft takes, it's always going to come back to nature and the elements. And mm-hmm. So if there's enough people that are doing that are paying attention to the trees or what color the sky is or how polluted the ground is, if there's enough people that's doing that, whether they get to that place from witchcraft or another way, it's still good. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always going to be gatekeepers in witchcraft, just like there are in any spiritual tradition, who are saying, like, you have to go through these certain steps and be initiated and all of that. And I, for me personally, it doesn't matter. If somebody decides they want to call themselves a witch and they start to study, then good. You know, there's... Mm-hmm. That's their true path, and they're going to relate to the elements and the earth in a new way, then there's, you know, that's only good. Not only good can come from that, but there's a lot of good that can come from that.
Okay, so we've focused on witches, and we focused on the feminine or the female side. What about the male side? Can't guys be witches too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of good friends that are male witches. I have a lot of good friends that are non-binary witches. So, you know, you don't have to be born female to be a witch at all. I think that in my practice, there still is something to masculine and feminine energy. However, I think that there is this immense stretching of possibility and like, what do those words really mean? And so I think it's important for witches, all witches, to always like try to kind of push the boundaries of language and ask themselves, what do I really mean when I say these words? Because there are no absolutes. Mm-hmm. And it always stuns me how like somebody who's a witch who's working with these really bizarre concepts like magic and spells, how they'll be so concrete in their view on something.
Yes.
You're a witch. You're not a banker or a CEO.
Mm-hmm. It that is truly amazing. And what has really caught my attention is the different flavors, if you will, of witchcraft, whether you're Gardenian or this one or that one or the other one, they're absolute mm-hmm. within their practice, and it's almost like mm-hmm. there's nobody else that, you know, nobody else's process counts, you know, and it's interesting to see, and I think that's going to evolve over time, but it's just interesting to see where it is now today. Now, in your book on page 115, you talk about the rag tree healing. What is that?
Mm-hmm. So the rag tree is this old Celtic tradition. Sometimes it's called the Clootie tree. And I think, I don't have the book in front of me actually, but I'm pretty sure I'm speaking about it in terms of gratitude magic. And summer, and you're sort of tying these rags on a tree in order to symbolize your gratitude moments. But traditionally, it was for healing purposes. So it was kind of a form of sympathetic magic where if you had somebody in your life that was sick or you yourself were sick, you would tie a small strip of fabric to a tree, hopefully not too tightly. That's become a problem in the old Celtic lands, is that there's all of these rags that are now strangling trees. So, you know, you would tie a rag to the tree, a tree that is, I think, traditionally grows near water. and it would be, you know, symbolizing a prayer, or that you're trying to heal this person through the energy of the tree and the land.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And a practice that you have in the book that I absolutely love, and I was actually doing it before we started talking, was the feeling mm-hmm. body, and that's where you put the tongue to the roof of your mouth. Could you explain that a little mm-hmm. bit more? Because it's so sensual. It's like, whoa.
Oh, yes. Well, tracing the tip of the tongue on the roof of the mouth, yeah, in like a figure eight symbol of infinity lemniscate motion is, yeah, that's always one of my go-tos. I think that, like, especially right now when we're so screen-bound, that to have these small, seemingly simple practices that'll bring you back to your body. So, like, just doing that simple practice of tracing the tongue on the roof of the mouth, and then asking yourself, what do I hear right now? What do I smell? And what do I see? Like, it seems simple. And were we, you know, still living very close to the land, it would maybe be something that we didn't need. But now that we're just so, you know, inside and screen bound, it is important to remind ourselves that we are fundamentally creatures, and our senses need to be tended to.
Yeah, and I found it to be very grounding, actually. You know, yes, mm-hmm. it's essential, but it's very grounding. It brings you right back to center. Now, Danielle, when mm-hmm. we go to your website, danielledelski.com, how do you work with people? I mean, you've got a lot of information on your site. How do you work with people? Are you teaching one-on-one, or is it just groups? Talk to us about that.
So most of what I facilitate is on, there is a link on my site to the Hag School website, but the Hag School is my platform for teaching. And right now, of course, all of that is online, but I do normally also teach in person. So I do lead retreats and facilitate certain in-person events and trainings. I have the Flame Tender training, which is a ritual facilitator training, and that's usually in person. We'll see if that happens this year. And then I do have large online groups. I have an online coven it's called the Hive of the Holy Wild Flesh, which is sort of a group for movement, but that also is exclusively online.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so anything coming up online in the near future?
Yeah, I have, so there's monthly meetings of the coven. That's usually on the first Sunday of the month, and then the Hive of the Holy Wild Flesh meets on the last Sunday of the month. So that's ongoing.
Okay. Yeah. In your book, the subtitle is The Wild Dreamer's Epic Journey of Becoming. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's, you know, that our journey's never over. So becoming is such a great word, I think, when it's used in that way, because it's like there's no, like I could have said epic journey of, I don't know, becoming wild or, becoming mm-hmm. something. But it can just be becoming, because we're just constantly changing all the time. Like, the only rule is that there's always going to be change. So, you know, the Wild Dreamer's Epic Journey of Becoming, it's like it's all about just the journey.
Okay,
we don't know where we're going to end up.
We sure don't. And folks, you know, by reading Danielle's book, the thing that I got out of it is don't be afraid of change. Okay, because that's the one thing you can't control. It's going to happen. One day, if you're breathing right now, you will not be breathing, and that's change. So don't
right.
be afraid of change at all. Danielle, our time is almost up. What pearl of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience today?
A pearl of wisdom. I think these strange and peculiar cocooned times just warrant that we reflect on the moments in our lives when we've really felt like purely present and fed and in the flow of the universe, these fleeting moments where we feel very whole and like we're not completely in this body-mind split where we usually are, with our mind running really fast and our body being still and bound and staring at a screen. So, like, look back. Use the cocoon times to look back on your life, starting in childhood, going forward, to those moments when you really felt in a place of embodied wholeness, like dancing, gardening, cooking, watching the sunrise, like these kind of fleeting moments, they come and they go, and then look for the patterns in those moments and see if you can shape a little bit more of your life to involve those patterns, those things that have always fed you. Yeah.
Okay, so great. And folks, in this time of being, you know, shut down, if you're still shut down, and if you're not shut down, be careful out there, because we're not getting the truth from our government. It's important to pay attention and to go within. And Danielle's book, Seasons of the Moon and Flame, will help you get there. It will allow you to think. She has an exercise in her book where she talks about, you know, getting up at dawn. And just looking outside and looking at the horizon and paying attention to what you see. I mean, that's something simple, but it also connects you to Earth, and it connects you to the rhythm and the flow of Earth, okay? And then you can, you know, consider delving deeper, but do pay attention. So, Danielle, thank you so much for being with me today as we collectively get over it. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Monique.
It was great having you. And folks, remember that the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of discovering witchcraft. Abundant blessings, light and love to all. Namaste.